Penguin Random House Audio presents Regenesis, Feeding the World Without Devouring the Planet. Written and read by George Monbiot.
Chapter 1. What Lies Beneath. It's a wonderful place for an orchard, but a terrible place for growing fruit. In central England, far from the buffering effect of the sea, the trees are blighted by late frosts. Freezing air flows like water, but here on this flat plot, dammed by rows of houses, it gathers and pools, drowning the orchard in cold. Every year, as the trees come into blossom, my hopes crack open with the breaking buds. Roughly 2 years out of three, they wither with the flowers. Frost curls into the branches like poison gas, shriveling and blackening the stamens. By autumn, the orchard is a living graph of spring temperatures. Apple varieties blossom at different but regular dates. Unless a freeze is especially hard, it damages only the open flower. From the trees, with and without fruit, you can tell when the frost struck, almost to the night. Every variety belongs to the same species, Malus domestica, which translates literally as tamed evil. The reasons for the age-old defamation of a lovely tree are complex, but one is likely to be etymological confusion. A dialect name for fruit, malon, appears to have slipped from Greek into Latin, where it was, so to speak, corrupted into malum, or evil. This single species, too good to be true, has been bred into thousands of different forms. Dessert apples, cooking apples, cider apples, drying apples, in an astonishing range of sizes, shapes, colours, scents and flavours. We grow Miller's seedling, which ripens in August and must be eaten from the tree, as the slightest jolt in transit bruises its translucent skin. It's sweet and soft, more juice than flesh. By contrast, the Wiccan pippin, hard as wood when picked, is scarcely edible till January, then stays crisp until the following May. We grow St. Edmund's pippin, which has skin like sandpaper and is dry and nutty and aromatic for 2 weeks in September, after which it turns to fluff, and the golden russet, whose taste and texture are almost identical, but only in February. The Ashmead's kernel, crunchy with a hint of caraway, my favourite apple, peaks in midwinter. The Reverend W. Wilkes puffs up like wool when you bake it and tastes like a smooth white wine. The cat's head, roasted at Christmas, is almost indistinguishable from mango puree. Ribston pippin, Mannington's pearmain, Kingston black, Cottenham seedling, Darcy spice, Belderboss scoop, Ellis bitter, these fruit are capsules of time and place, culture and nature. As every tree requires subtly different conditions to prosper, some do better here than others. Some varieties are so finely adapted to their place of origin that they perform disappointingly on the other side of the same hill. By choosing breeds that blossom at different times, we've sought in this orchard to spread the risk. Even so, in bad years, when frost strikes repeatedly, we lose almost everything. But yes, despite the many broken dreams, it's a wonderful place for an orchard. When I arrived this morning, its beauty made me gasp. The first apple trees have come into flower, the pink buds uncurling to reveal their pale hearts. The pear and cherry trees are in full sail, carrying so much white blossom that their branches lift slightly in the breeze. I walk the rows of trees, smelling them. Every variety has a different faint scent. Some of the blooms smell like hyacinth, some like lilac, some like daphne or viburnum. I believe I can tell when a flower has been pollinated. The perfume, no longer needed to attract bees and hoverflies, is immediately cut off. The pear blossom, pure white with 20 black stamens like tiny cloven hooves, stinks revoltingly of anchovies. The cherry petals are beginning to flake from the trees, drifting and feathering in the light wind. The new grass is streaked with shadow. Wood pigeons growl in the plum trees. To have all this within a few hundred metres of our home feels like an astonishing luxury, a luxury for which, between the five families who share it, we pay just £75 a year. The orchard occupies three adjoining plots on an allotment site. Since 1878 in England, local governments have allotted land for people to cultivate vegetables and fruit. In principle, since 1908, we've all had the legal right to grow. What this legislation inadvertently spread was anarchy in its true sense. In other words, it created thousands of self-organized, self-governing communities, otherwise known as commons. Though the local government owns the land, it's managed and run by the people who work it. Our site in Oxford is divided into 220 plots, cultivated by people who have arrived in the city from all over the world. We cross-pollinate each other's knowledge with grains of peculiar experience. 17 years ago, the allotments seemed to be dying. Only 1/10 of the plots were occupied. The remnant community was desperate for people to take them on, otherwise the local authority would reclaim the site for housing. They leased me 2.5 adjoining plots, one of which was covered in monstrous brambles, snaking 3 metres into the air. I spent a month cutting the stems with a bush knife and hacking out the root balls with a mattock. Beneath them, sleeping beauty lay. Meadow grasses, cowslips, oxeye daisies, germander speedwell, vetch, knapweed, woodaven, scabious, yarrow, ribwort plantain, cat's ear and hawkbit sprang from the soil. The seeds must have lain dormant for decades. I persuaded a couple of friends to join me, and we planted the plots with heritage fruit trees, mostly apples with a few plums, cherries and pears, a medlar and a quince. Just as the trees became productive, I left Oxford and moved to Wales. Abandoning the orchard was among my few regrets. My friends passed it to others, who in turn passed it on. 5 years later, unexpectedly for family reasons, I returned. I didn't want to be back. But soon after I arrived, one of my best friends in the city told me that some people who'd recently moved away had passed him a beautiful orchard, planted on the allotments a few years before. He couldn't manage it alone and remembered that I knew something about fruit trees. It felt like coming home. Now, though it covers less than 1/10 of a hectare, the orchard sometimes feels like half my world. It's the living calendar that marks my year. We've brought in 3 other families, creating a miniature commons within a commons. Every couple of months we organise a work day with a break for lunch beneath the trees. In late winter and spring, we prune the apples and pears. In May and September, we mow the grass. In June, we thin the fruit. In October, we harvest the apples, store the sound fruit, and if the crop warrants it, spend a frantic day chopping, scratting, pressing, pasteurising, and bottling the rest, turning some into juice and some into cider. In midwinter, we wassail the orchard. Wassailing is a scientific procedure deployed to ensure the trees produce a good crop the following season. The methodology consists of singing and drinking cider. According to a well-tested hypothesis, the crop the trees bear is directly proportional to the effort expended. For more or less fruits they will bring, as you do give them wassailing. The hypothesis is not upheld. Then we begin the cycle again. By mid-morning I'm 6 feet from the ground, with a bow saw and long-handled pruning saw. Our lovely allotment neighbour, Stuart, has decided he's too old to manage his fruit trees, so he has passed his row, which abuts our orchard, to us, completing our 3 plots. His old trees are in a sorry state, the limbs congested and either sweeping the ground or rising so high that the fruit they bear is unharvestable. So I'm standing in the cherry tree, among branches so packed with blossom that you can barely see the bark, committing a desecration. Whereas apples and pears can be pruned in the winter, stone fruit has to be pruned while the sap is rising in the spring or early summer. Otherwise, you expose the trees to infection by canker, leaf curl, or silverleaf. This means you must perform the awful sacrilege of carving up a tree in flower or fruit. The snowy branches crash to the ground in a blizzard of petals. Though this violation offends me, I love pruning. It has almost become an end in itself, as much sculpture as management. When you've completed the big structural cuts, you trim the remaining twigs back to a bud that points in the direction you want the new growth to follow. As the tree spreads, it assumes the shape you've bidden it to take. I favour the Spanish or goblet style, moulding the tree into a broad cup. If you get it right, this exposes every leaf to sunlight.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?